KPCW News Time is 8:06. You are listening to the local news hour. Well, somehow I don't think we're going to get the 2 feet of snow that Syracuse got, but let's see what's in store for our weather. Here with a report is Cedric Haynes with the ABC 4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Friday. We are going to be dealing with off and on valley rain showers and a few mountain snow showers, where we could see a couple of inches of snow through the midday time frame. This is not going to be a significant event, but overall, still some leftover mountain snow showers above 7,500 feet and valley rain showers through lunchtime. As we get into the afternoon, look for drier conditions with partly cloudy skies. Temperatures climbing to around 40 degrees for your high in the Park City area. We'll see those highs climbing into the mid-40s in the Heber Valley. Tonight, get ready for those temperatures to dip down into the 20s as we go throughout your Friday night into Saturday morning, with highs in the mid-40s for us in Park City. For Saturday afternoon, highs near 50 in the Heber Valley. Saturday will be your pick day of the weekend across the Wasatch Back, as we are going to be tracking our next storm system, which moves in as early as late Saturday night and will definitely be with us as we go throughout the day on Sunday. Your Sunday forecast calls for more valley rain to take place here, with more moisture moving in from the west. Once you get above about 7,500 feet, that's where we could see some valley rain and snow mixed together going into the mountain valleys, heading up into the higher elevations. The mountains will be seeing mainly snow. But again, accumulations could be adding up to about 3 to 6 inches for the mountains above about 7,500 feet as we go throughout the day on your Sunday. As we go into your Sunday night into Monday, colder air will work its way in, so we could see some snowflakes mixing down into the Heber Valley, with snow likely for us as we head into your Monday morning for the Park City area. Highs on Monday will only be in the upper 30s in Park City, with low to mid 40s for the Heber Valley. Heading into Tuesday and Wednesday, we'll see mostly cloudy skies. Overall, mainly dry conditions, but colder air will continue to be in place. Highs only in the mid to upper 30s in Park City, with highs in the low 40s in the Heber Valley. And all eyes will be on the end of next week, Thursday into Friday. Could have a setup that could produce some widespread snowfall across both the valleys and the mountains. It's still early, so no need to hang our hats on this just yet, but it is a time frame that we're going to be watching for you very closely. Let's look at your latest forecast from the ABC 4 Forecast Center. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Let's do a little bit of local news. A Colville Golf Resort's main creditors are fighting back against the Park City businessman trying to buy it amid bankruptcy. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports it's the next turn on Wahali's path toward auction.
The private company EB-5AN, which helps administer a federal immigrant investor program, is looking to secure its stake in a beleaguered Summit County golf resort. In a court filing December 12th, it asked a federal bankruptcy judge to declare once and for all that EB-5 and its clients are first in line to be paid by Wahali in Colville. It comes as Park City businessman Doug Bergeron is offering to loan the resort money to help it restructure, potentially moving himself to the front of the line. He bought about $3,000 of Wahali's debt to gain standing in its bankruptcy proceedings after announcing his intention to buy and continue developing the resort last year. EB-5 has so far offered the best loan terms, according to the court-appointed trustee. The trustee's guiding Wahali through bankruptcy for its owners, some of whom are suing one another. But Bergeron's attorneys, including from the New York firm Sullivan & Cromwell, and lawyers for people who bought home lots in Wahali, have criticized EB-5 in court. They characterize the investors EB-5AN represents as lending to Wahali primarily for green cards without needing or expecting repayment. The EB-5 Immigrant Investor Program is intended to help U.S. projects get affordable financing by offering permanent residency status to foreign investors. Wahali secured an almost $80 million loan through the program. EB-5 says it's owed that and millions more in interest. The investors' identities are not known since the federal program is confidential, but EB-5AN manager Mike Schoenfeld explains that investors in the program are usually families from countries with large populations that might have an annual limit or quota for visas. He says sometimes investors are already in the U.S. or have children at American universities and are looking for a way to stay long-term. The program requires each immigrant investor to spend at least $800,000 and create 10 project-related jobs. Schoenfeld says that's a large amount of money for most, and they would be eager to have it back. EB-5AN published a blog post near the end of last year explaining to its investors the paths to getting their money back. The blog also provides an explanation for why Wahali ran out of money in the first place, stating that many business challenges can affect a project like this, but EB5AN believes the specific issues for Wahali came from slow sales and the developer's choice to prioritize spending primarily on infrastructure and amenities. According to the blog, Wahali's 18-hole golf course is complete, and an executive course in some townhomes are partially built. Wahali is allowed to build more than 400 housing units of various kinds. Development paused once the resort filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protections in August. The blog states that was likely in response to EB5's attempt to foreclose on Wahali. All the parties are due back in bankruptcy court later this month to see who will get to loan Wahali the money it needs to restructure. The subsequent court ruling may affect who's in the best position to get paid or foreclose on the property. According to court testimony, Wahali is likely to get auctioned off in the spring. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Coming up, I'm going to be speaking with Janelle Fitzgerald of the Wasatch Health Department about some of the illnesses that are raging around our area. Then hydrologist Spencer Donovan will call in to talk about Utah's water conditions. And we'll finish our hour by chatting with Kendra Wyckoff of Peace House. Stay tuned. People incarcerated in the Wasatch County Jail can further their education thanks to a program through the Wasatch County School District. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has more.
The Wasatch County School District's adult education program provides a pathway for people over 18 to earn the equivalent of a high school diploma by passing the General Educational Development, or GED, tests. Amanda Edwards is an administrator for Wasatch Alternative High School. She says teachers in the program are trained to meet students where they are, regardless of their educational background.
We have some students who come in ready to pass any of the assessments right away, and we have other students who come in and have gaps, say, in math, and then the classroom instruction looks like our teachers filling the gaps that they have.
That includes students in the county jail who want to pursue their GED. Classes in jail are taught weekly by Kathy Carr, who's also a leader at the Wasatch Community Foundation.
She's absolutely amazing. We're just lucky enough here to have a great relationship with our jail to be able to then celebrate graduations.
Many people are in jail for relatively short periods of time. For sentences longer than a year, they're sent to the state prison. But some individuals spend a long time in jail waiting for a case to work its way through court. The Wasatch County Sheriff's Office also has an agreement to house some state prisoners in exchange for funding. For people incarcerated over longer periods, Wasatch Alternative High School Principal Todd Johnson says education can be a lifeline.
You know, there are inmates that are there for years, and it gives them hope and something to work on. In fact, we just celebrated a graduation.
Johnson says the student's mother was able to attend the graduation and celebrate with her daughter.
This recent graduate, you know, she said, this is something that has been a goal for mine for a long time. And especially as her mother was there to celebrate that with her, and that was fun to see.
Edwards says that even for students serving shorter jail terms, attending classes is time well spent.
What we really hope to do is just spark that learning again and get them back, you know, get students believing in themselves. That's what education is all about, right?
She says many former students from the jail program go on to share success stories with the district. Once students have their GEDs, they can often access higher paying jobs or enroll in post-secondary classes. Edwards says many alternative high school alumni pursue programs through Mountainland Technical College. Nationally, education can make a key difference for people in jails and prisons. A 2016 report from the RAND Corporation, a policy research organization, found that people who participate in any kind of education while incarcerated are up to 43% less likely to reoffend. They're also more likely to find jobs once released. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
There's been a fair amount of illness circulating in the Wasatch back this holiday season. On the phone to help us understand what's going on and what you can do to stay healthy is Janelle Fitzgerald of the Wasatch County Health Department. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
So, Janelle, anecdotally, I've certainly heard of a lot of people getting sick over the holidays. What does the data tell us? Is there really a lot of illness going around?
There is, actually. What we're seeing, there's the Utah Department of Health tracks influenza-like illness, and those mainly being COVID, influenza, and then RSV, which most severely impacts kids. But what we're seeing going on right now is quite a bit of influenza, and we're also seeing that in Wasatch County with the busyness, I guess, of our urgent care and emergency room at the Wasatch County, the Heber Valley Hospital. A lot of sickness going around, yes.
And I've read that statewide, there's something like 400 people currently hospitalized for influenza. Is that an unusual number? And are we really seeing not only a large number, but some increase in the severity of the illness that we're seeing?
I guess I can't speak to exactly where we're at with hospitalizations. I know we do have some Wasatch County residents hospitalized. When we talk about reportable illnesses for public health, hospitalizations of influenza-like illness are reportable. And so we do get those numbers, and we do have folks that are hospitalized from Wasatch County as well. As far as are we having unusual amounts, mm-hmm. I can't really speak to that. There is on the state's dashboard a hospitalization occupancy report, and it shows that we are at a higher level. I don't know that we would say that we're at critical levels right now. That would be something I would, you know, ask the hospital.
So I guess one of the questions I had is whether, as I understand it, the flu shot formula, the flu vaccine formula changes from year to year. Are you seeing, is this year's flu vaccine effective against the strains we're seeing?
So we did have a very effective flu vaccine prior to about September, when we started seeing what they are calling a subclade K variant of the flu start circulating. And that strain has not been affected as much by the vaccine. So the vaccine is less effective than we thought it was going to be. Still, it does help. So basically getting a flu shot would take a influenza illness that could be incredibly severe and makes it a little bit more mild. So even though the subclade K is less impacted or less protected by the flu vaccine, it still does reduce the severity of the illness, and we see less hospitalizations, especially in young people who have been vaccinated.
Can you sort of shed a little light on how they figure out how to change the formula for the vaccine every year, and when do they do that?
Oh, gosh. Not my expertise.
No, okay.
Exactly.
I'm not trying to stump the expert. It's just as I was listening to this, I was just wondering, like, you know, you're trying to figure out a defensive mechanism, and it's an interesting question as to how they do it and why it is they didn't see this one particular strain sort of evading. It sounds like it's getting around the vaccine to some extent. Is it too late to get the shot?
No, definitely not too late. So you're right. I do know that we start that our vaccine manufacturers do start trying to figure out what strains they expect to be seeing in the coming season months ahead of time, right? And it takes a while to get that vaccine the way that they think that it should be. And we start giving flu shots in September. So this subclade K variant, we didn't even see it coming. It was something that didn't exist until this fall, and so obviously it wasn't something that was in the vaccine. I guess I forgot the question.
The main question was, is it too late? Are we still recommending people who have not chosen to
absolutely.
Get the vaccine to go ahead and get it?
Yeah, absolutely. If you haven't got the flu shot yet, it's not too late to do that. And we do continue to see flu. It's peaking about now generally on a yearly timeline. But we're going to continue to see influenza circulate, and getting the shot right now will be protective, right? Let's go ahead and get vaccinated as much as possible, and it reduces illnesses and reduces hospitalization, and like I said earlier, reduces the severity of that sickness. Flu is not fun to have, and we want to, you know, keep that away as much as possible, but it's always nice to have it not as badly or not as severely as we could as well.
Along the lines of things that are not fun to have, anecdotally, I understand there's a fair amount of GI illness going around. What have you seen in that respect?
We're hearing that that's circulating as well. And interestingly, Sometimes some folks will confuse the two, and there's a number of reasons for getting a stomach bug, right? And some folks will say, "Oh, I got the flu, even though I got the shot." When they do get throwing up and diarrhea, influenza is different, as you say, from a GI illness, and we do see that circulating as well. And it's not to be confused with influenza, which influenza is severe, you know, chills and fever, body aches, fatigue with the cough and sore throat. A GI stomach bug is completely different. There's not a vaccine for that. You need to similar, I guess, ways to protect yourself. Wash your hands, stay home if you're sick because they can be spread.
And when people come down with something like a norovirus, a GI infection, what steps should they be taking to try to get back from that? And when, if ever, should they seek medical attention?
Oh, mostly stay hydrated. Folks, if you're throwing up or have severe diarrhea, you can get dehydrated, and that's the most dangerous situation, and so you might need a Gatorade and things like that. And if you are getting dehydrated, that's the time that you might need to go to the doctor and possibly have an IV if it's getting to be severe. But most of the time, people can get over that by themselves. Just stay home, rest up, but make sure to stay hydrated.
And when are there signs to recognize when you are so dehydrated that you should be thinking about going to urgent care, getting an IV? Are there symptoms? Are there signals that, hey, you know, I haven't had anything to drink. I haven't been able to keep anything down for 12 hours, 20 hours. What should people be looking for as to when to pull that trigger?
Oh, gosh. I'd need to refer you to one of our nurses or medical folks for that kind of recommendation.
Okay. I want to talk about measles. Are we seeing measles cases in Wasatch County at this point?
We have. So in, November, we had some measles cases, mostly at the high school in Wasatch County. We only saw 9 cases. There may have been some other mild cases, but interestingly, and as a good report, we in our last 2 wastewater samples, we did not detect measles in Wasatch County. So by all indications, you know, information from clinics, from doctors, and our wastewater samples, we do not have measles in Wasatch County right now. And we know that it's still around in other parts of Utah, and wouldn't be surprised to see it pop up again. But with that one especially, we know that vaccination is incredibly effective, right? The MMR vaccine is about 95 to 97% effective. And if you've been vaccinated against measles, your likelihood of getting it is very low.
And the other thing I want to touch on before we go is tips. What do you want our listeners to do to try to, you know, maximize the chances of staying healthy this winter?
Oh, sure. One, good hygiene. Wash your hands. But stay home if you're sick. Nobody wants to get sick. So if you are sick or you have kids that are sick, school, and with school starting again after the holidays, is a place where sickness really circulates. So keep your kids home if they're sick. The other thing that you can do is, be healthy, get good nutrition and exercise. We actually have a diabetes prevention class starting here at the health department in the next couple of weeks. And get a hold of us and get involved in some classes, make a New Year's resolution to do those things that we know help our bodies to be healthier. And by doing so, we're more able to protect ourselves against illness as well.
Okay, Janelle Fitzgerald, thanks so much for spending time with us. Anything you wanted to add before we go?
Just get a hold of us at the Wasatch County Health Department. We've got vaccine. We've got the flu vaccine. We've got MMR vaccine. We can also help you with recommendations for other healthy lifestyles. So give us a call if you'd like to be involved or get a vaccine. The number to call for vaccine appointment is 435-657-3307.
Janelle, thanks very much for joining me, and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, this winter season is not only noteworthy because there isn't a whole lot of snow. There really hasn't been that much precipitation of any kind in the last couple of months, other than the last few days. Here to help us understand what we have seen and its impact is Spencer Donovan, a hydrologist with the Utah Snow Survey. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So, first of all, let's start with what is the Utah Snow Survey? What is the organization you work for, Spencer?
Yeah, so there's a few of these programs throughout the West. We're part of the NRCS, sub-agency of the USDA. What we do is we run a network of weather stations throughout the West. My office in particular is in charge of overseeing Utah and Nevada, and there's about 250 of those sites that we oversee and maintain, and those are used to predict water flow, water stream flow, and reservoir levels. Yeah.
And we'll get to that because I'm really interested in where the reservoirs are, but let's start with the moisture situation in the fall. As we came into September, October, what were things looking like?
Yeah, so, you know, we ended our year precipitation-wise at normal. That was for the water year last year. That was in large part due to kind of the average snow year we had. However, you know, as you might remember, the northern half of the state did really well, whereas the southern half was sort of left in dire states. However, yeah, like you asked about the fall conditions, you might recall during October we sort of had that record-breaking rain period. And so that's sort of in large why our precipitation numbers at this point look pretty good or are above normal.
And because what's happened since then is not a whole lot, I take it.
Yeah, so it's kind of, from a liquid precipitation perspective, that's, you know, just rainfall, we're actually doing really well. But as we're all painfully aware, yeah, that's been rain instead of snow moving into the winter season.
So where does the snowpack stand now? I mean, visually, it doesn't look like there's much, but let's get a more educated perspective on that.
Yeah. Visually, it's pretty rough out here. You know, I kind of was excited to come up here just to see how bad it is. Yeah, like I said, precipitation-wise, the state's looking, you know, really good, but snowpack-wise, we're about 50% of normal, near or at record lows.
That was what I wanted to get a sense of was, obviously, anecdotally, it all feels like this is extraordinary, but what you're saying is that it really is extraordinary.
Yeah, it really is extraordinary. You know, on a statewide average, we're sitting at about the fourth percentile of record lows, and that's coming from our network, which was established more or less in the 1980s. And yeah, it's just been bumping along that record low since the beginning of the snow year.
Okay, so again, to try to understand this, when you say fourth percentile, if we just say since 1980, what you're saying is this is like almost near the bottom.
Almost right? Near the bottom.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
bottom 4%.
And I'm sure for our listeners who are going, yeah, but can it get better? Historically, have we seen, you know, snowpacks bounce back from this kind of dismal start?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's important not to get too hung up on where it is now because, in fact, January through April is kind of where we acquire the bulk of our snowpack. And so at this point in the year, you know, it's just two or three storms could really put us back on track.
Okay. And you mentioned that we're, you know, sort of overall from a precipitation perspective, we're not in a bad place. Are all the reservoirs like the Jordanelle, are they at normal levels?
Yeah, we kind of finished the year out kind of the same as we did last year. Again, the southern half of the state is below normal and kind of in dire shape, so they're going to have to, you know, make decisions accordingly, depending on how this year turns out. But yeah, from a reservoir and water supply perspective, we're not sitting in a terrible position.
And I guess a related question is, the reservoirs are okay. Great Salt Lake, I know from time to time we hear that it's in dire shape. Is it
sure.
Better as well?
Sure. So where it sits now, it's about 6 feet below where we would like it to be. It comes up in the spring, and then it kind of just peters off as we move into the snow year or as the summer wears on. It's a tough one to forecast, but we're doing our best to get better at that, and it's just going to depend on how the snow year turns out.
And so, as we look around, there's really not much to do but sort of hope that things, again, have turned around as they have historically. Let's talk a little bit more about what conditions are in the southern part of the state.
Sure. So, again, from that precipitation perspective, that rainfall, they're doing really well, like 150% of normal. And that's just because of those October rains. And even now, when it should have been snowing, it's been raining a lot. So they are adding a lot of moisture to the soil and things like that. But from a snowfall perspective, yeah, it's kind of statewide. We're at about 40, 50% of normal.
What do things look like? You mentioned that you look at other states. What states are you sort of are you involved with?
So my office in particular, our snow survey office, oversees Utah and Nevada, and we forecast stream flow and reservoir levels for both of those states. And yeah, it's kind of the same story for both Nevada and Utah.
And again, we can't really forecast a turnaround. You can only hope for one at this
point. Can only hope for one. Yeah, I heard you had the ABC News Weather Service guy on beforehand earlier this morning. And, you know, he did a great job of just pointing out that you can't really hang your hat on any one situation or another. Yeah. I mean, we do have a series of storms coming in, which is great news, and it will. Temperatures will get down to those more normal winter temperatures. So just hope for the best.
And for those who are throwing their hands up and saying, oh my gosh, this is, you know, the long term is really dark, do you have a sense of what's going on in other parts of the country? I mean, you get a sense that back east, they're really getting a lot of snow.
Yeah, back east, Vermont, you know, I think they're still sitting at, they might have the most snow in the state. I know the North Cascades have been doing pretty well recently, even after that early flooding they had about a month ago. But yeah, some of those eastern snow sites like Jay Peak and Mount Mansfield, yeah, they have a ton of snow.
And again, to go back to it, there aren't any magic tools that you can look at. People talk about jet streams, people talk about Nina.
Sure.
Is there anything we can look at that gives you a sign for what we might expect?
Yeah, so those ENSO cycles, El Nino, La Nina, they do play a big role for those coastal locations. But for Utah, they're just not great predictors. You know, they might say there's a 53% chance that we have an above average or below average year, which is essentially a coin flip. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a useful tool, but it's not something you want to hang your hat on.
I got no magic bullets in your bag this morning, Spencer.
you know, if you want to look at things more optimistically, you know, PC Mar here, it looks pretty dire, but so we run a snowtell that's located up at the top of the Thames Canyon lift. And right now, just like the rest of the state, that's sitting at kind of record lows. But from a, you know, quantifiable perspective, it's only 2.5 to 3 inches of snow water equivalent below that median level. So that is just 2-3 decent-sized storms, and it's right back where we're used to seeing it.
And I guess that's the best we can hope for.
Yeah, yeah.
Spencer, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
You know, one more positive thing is our ground soil is very moist, you know, much better than we usually see. So when we do finally move into that runoff season, we'll hopefully have a much more efficient runoff and a lot more of that water ending up in our streams and reservoirs.
And hopefully that bodes well for a fire season, right? If we have moisture, does that help us with that?
You know, the fire season, that's kind of a surface dryness thing.
Ah, okay.
But as far as our farmers, ranchers, water users, yeah, hopefully we get waters in our streams.
All right, Spencer, thanks for spending time with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back after this. About 250 kids and their families rang in the new year early at the Park City Library, celebrating at noon instead of midnight. KPCW's Christine Weller has more on the event.
The Park City Library was bustling with activity Wednesday afternoon as families with young children celebrated New Year's Eve ahead of the actual New Year at midnight. Throughout the first floor of the library, interactive craft stations were set up. A party hat featuring meteors and stars to color, a festive wreath made from two shades of green paper, a sparkly star wand for making wishes, and a noisemaker made from a paper plate and dried beans to loudly ring in the new year. 7-year-old Indra Northwood's favorite craft was the noisemaker, which was decked out with stickers and film stars.
Well, we say Happy New Year!
Her mom, Molly Guinan, said they attended the New Year's celebration last year.
There's a lot of kids from her school, and so it's kind of a nice after the holidays get together with all the parents and kids in one spot.
5-year-old Blakely Key's favorite activity was making a party hat.
I'm using green on the stars, green on these little stars too, and red on these meteors because I want to make them look like there's fire on them, and then the moon's yellow.
She was excited to spend time with her grandma, visiting from Texas, and spend the night at her cousin's house. Andrew Wolford attended with his 5-year-old daughter, Iris. She also favored making party hats and colored hers purple.
I love that the locals put on this event and allow our little kids to do a noon ball drop because they're not going to make it till midnight.
The highlight of the new New Year's Eve party was the balloon drop. Counting down from 5, the crowd cheered as the clock hit noon and balloons and confetti rained down from the second floor of the library. Library specialist Danielle Bean organized the event.
I've gotten very good at tying balloons now, so not a skill I thought I'd learn at the library, but it is.
She said last year's first-time event was a big success, so the library brought it back for 2025. And with another year of success, the party will be back again ahead of 2027. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
The Utah Republican Party's bid to repeal an anti-gerrymandering law through a new citizen ballot initiative is drawing support from some voters. The Salt Lake Tribune reports a status report from the Utah Lieutenant Governor's office shows the GOP is 9% of the way toward reaching its signature goal. The party has until February 14th to collect almost 141,000 signatures and meet specific thresholds in 26 of the state's 29 Senate districts for the repeal effort to qualify for the November 3rd ballot. The state reports that just over 12,000 signatures have been submitted and verified by county clerks to date. Republicans want to repeal the Better Boundaries Initiative, a voter-improved ballot measure that banned partisan gerrymandering in Utah in 2018. Also known as Proposition 4, it established an independent commission to draw the state's congressional district map. The party launched its initiative effort in response to a series of court rulings that said the legislature violated the Utah Constitution when it tossed out the commission's map in favor of its own to keep all four congressional districts safely in Republican hands. The court selected an alternative for the 2026 election that creates a Democratic-leaning seat in the northern part of Salt Lake County. The Tribune reports the Utah signature-gathering efforts are reported being bankrolled by a dark money group affiliated with President Donald Trump. Republicans have received more than $4.3 million to hire paid signature gatherers. Well, skiers and split boarders can now hike up and ride down a home run. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports Park City Mountain's uphill laps opened later this season due to the weather.
Park City Mountain spokesperson Bailey Quinn says reopening uphill terrain took careful consideration this winter because of the unseasonably dry and warm weather. She said that until recently, mountain operations equipment was required to use portions of the designated uphill route, which would have not allowed for safe uphill travel. Uphill travel is free from 6 p.m. to 8 a.m. A new stoplight on the bridge above Home Run will be green when uphillings open and red when closed. Skiers and riders can hike up to Angle Station on Home Run and the lower Silver Skis Run. The downhill route is the same in reverse. Straying from Home Run or lower Silver Skis is prohibited. Numerous hazards exist after hours, including winch cats, buried snowmaking hoses, and avalanche bombs. The resort says another common infraction is bringing dogs. Service dogs are allowed. Climbers are asked to stay on climbers' left during the ascent and to wear a headlamp and high-visibility clothing. Also new this year, the resort has set up text alerts for uphillers. To sign up, text UPHILL to 435-244-1769. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Joining me in the studio now is Kendra Wyckoff of Peace House to talk about what to expect this year and what the past year has been like. Morning, Kendra, and thanks for being here.
Good morning. Happy New Year, everyone.
That works a lot better.
There we go.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what this past year has been like for Peace House. As I understand it, there were some cuts to funding by state lawmakers in this past year. How has it affected your operations?
Well, this past year, we haven't had cuts from state lawmakers. We saw a lot of action from our federal administration, changing some priorities, and making some changes that have a ripple effect in the work that we do. Specifically, one of the things that we can speak to is the housing and urban development funding. So there's been a lot of changes in priorities for HUD. And sometimes people think, oh, you know, how is that related to domestic violence and sexual assault services? Well, here in Utah, you know, domestic violence is one of the number one reasons why women and children face homelessness in our state. And I can tell you in the service area that we provide services, Summit and Wasatch County, that is the number one cause of homelessness is domestic violence. So it is very, very applicable to the work that we do. And we actually receive some funding that supports survivors. We receive some funding at a state level that's not HUD funding, that is specifically to serve folks who've experienced homelessness. And we also have received funding over the years to help rehome survivors with permanent housing support. And that's where we're seeing a significant shift with the federal funding. They are no longer prioritizing that permanent housing support, and they're looking at funding programs that are transitional in nature with an emphasis on treatment.
So historically, HUD had programs that would specifically sort of help you find permanent housing support for domestic violence victims?
Yes. Well, basically, the funding would allow us to pay for rental assistance and deposits to get people into permanent housing. And with that funding shift, now we are not going to see that funding coming into this next year. We understand that, you know, the administration makes priority changes, but this is a very significant shift, not only for the population that serves domestic violence survivors, but for folks who are experiencing homelessness in general. It really takes away from a model that has been very successful, and that model is called Housing First. If we can get people housed first, then we can work on addressing other issues that they have and make sure that they're stable enough to be able to move through the process of whether that's healing from domestic violence or getting the support that they need to address chronic homelessness.
And Kendra, has there been an explanation as to what the model that HUD wants to move to? What is the thinking or the articulated sort of basis for the shift, or is it just a funding cut?
I mean, well, I think it's more of a priority shift. There is a focus on really looking at folks who experience chronic homelessness and what are some of the challenges around chronic homelessness, which, you know, we know there are persistent mental health and co-occurring issues with substance abuse. The federal administration is looking at prioritizing funding that supports programs that require people to go into treatment and be housed transitionally. And then, you know, I think that their hope is that those folks would be more stable to be able to be housed permanently. The challenge is that what happens when folks exit a transitional situation and there's no permanent housing funding to support them, whether they're dealing with those types of issues, and specifically the impact to Peace Houses, you know, dealing with the issue of fleeing an abusive relationship and trying to restabilize and be in a safe, affordable housing unit. Being homeless is very disruptive for anybody. And in particular, you know, when we look at the population we serve, domestic violence and sexual assault survivors, our goal is to help decrease that disruption, increase safety, and increase stability. And those permanent housing dollars are really important.
Now, have there been sort of direct funding impacts on Peace House? We're talking about sort of the programs that you help administer. Let's talk about more direct funding. Have you seen direct funding impacts from changes in administration priorities?
We have not had a direct impact as of yet. However, going into this legislative session, we are very concerned about protecting the funding that we do have. And just to give a little history there, 3 years ago, the state of Utah, they approved, our legislators, and we were so grateful, approved a very strong victim services package. Some of that went to programs like Peace House, and we were able to benefit both our domestic violence and sexual assault services. So we were able to receive about $300,000 more. The challenge is that funding was partially ongoing and partially one time. And the one time funding expires June 30 of 2026. So right now we are in a position where we are really wanting to ensure that there are not budget cuts and that funding that is one time, that there is, you know, support to ensure that funding can be at least continued into the next fiscal year. We would love to see it be ongoing so that we're not having to revisit that issue. What I can tell you is that if we do not receive that one-time funding, if that is not approved going into the next fiscal year, it's about $160,000 cut in funding to Peace House.
And what is that? Just give it.
Primarily, it does provide a cut in our domestic violence program. Yeah. So, I mean, for our domestic violence programs, it is potentially losing a staff member. For our sexual assault program, it's potentially losing 2.5 staff members. And that is extremely impactful because our sexual assault program is new. It's about 5 years in running. We have seen incredible success in working with survivors. We provide services to over 100 survivors annually. Last year, we had 17 hospital response calls that we responded to the hospital to provide support. So it's critical because we're getting momentum in the community and people are understanding that service is available and more survivors are coming forward for the support that they need and hopefully working with the criminal justice system as well, because as we collaborate with them, we have the opportunity to be able to provide those community-based programs. So it could be devastating.
And are you hearing rumblings from the legislature that this funding might be on the chopping block?
Well, no. I mean, here's the good news. I want to really just say thank you to our governor. He has put in his budget that he released in December that request to ensure that one-time funding does get funded going into the next fiscal year. So we have the governor's office support, and we're very grateful for that. They've been incredible champions over the years. We're hopeful that positioning will help encourage our legislators to really continue down that pathway and ensure that funding is available into the next fiscal year. But it's hard to know until you get into the session, and you know there are a lot of needs, and we understand that there are a lot of needs. So we want to be at the table advocating for the needs that we're seeing at Peace House and across the state in general for domestic violence and sexual assault survivors.
That's what I was going to ask you about. I mean, I guess intuitively I wouldn't have thought that a significant part of your job was lobbying, but the reality is that these are important funding sources. Do you work together with other sort of domestic violence organizations throughout the state? Do you guys have like a lobbying club, for lack of a better term?
And
tell us a little bit about how you approach that whole process.
Absolutely. So we are members of several state coalitions, the Utah Domestic Violence Coalition and the Utah Sexual Assault Coalition. We're also a member of the Utah Nonprofit Association. But specifically with our domestic violence and sexual assault coalitions, we work as a collective group of community-based programs here in Utah. The domestic violence program, there are 15 of us that serve 29 counties that are nonprofit organizations, and they do have folks that support the policy work. So I sit on a policy committee with the Domestic Violence Coalition. I sit on a policy committee with the Sexual Assault Coalition. And our goal is to prioritize, have legislative priorities every year. So for the Domestic Violence Coalition this year, it is to, you know, retain that funding and to be keeping our eye on other legislative bills that could have an impact on survivors, whether that's through the criminal or civil system. We're also looking at things like HUD and the housing and the homelessness funding in the state and being strong advocates in that space as well, so that people can understand that some of those changes have a ripple effect into other populations, such as those that we serve at Peace House. Sexual Assault Coalition, the same thing. So we do have groups of people who work to provide that education and advocate to our legislators. You know, we're constantly talking with them. They've been wonderful in our community here. They've come out to tour Peace House over the years. They ask a lot of questions about what we're doing and what our services are and how we are funded. And I think that we just have to be at the forefront of those conversations. Otherwise, because there are so many needs, we can get lost in the shuffle.
And do you actually, you know, so you spend time meeting with legislators. Do you actually do hands-on lobbying?
Yeah, I do go to the Capitol. Yep, I do. And spend time meeting with legislators and talking with them and encouraging them to support our priorities. We want to make sure that we can maintain and sustain the programs that we have. And if we're not there, you know, doing that work, then, like I said, people don't know what is happening in community, right? So it's important. Legislators, they have their fingers in so many different areas and topics and issues of concern. And they're not experts necessarily in all areas. And so it's important for us as the experts to be at the Hill, being able to provide that information and share that information.
Now, you mentioned that obviously you serve both Summit and Wasatch counties. Have you seen an increase in the number of survivors that you are seeing from Wasatch County over recent years?
Yeah, absolutely. We have seen a significant increase over the last couple of years. We've been doing a lot of very focused outreach work in the community. We do not have a physical office there, but we do what we call mobile advocacy. So we go into community and we go to the food bank at the Christian Center. We go to the library several times a month so that we can be accessible to folks in the community who might not be able to make it over the Hill to get to Park City. And it's twofold. It's one to, you know, help people connect with services. services, but also to educate and let people know what services are available so that they can share that information broadly. So we have seen a significant increase. If we look at year over year, we saw 100% increase from the previous fiscal year into our most current fiscal year. We saw about 35% of the people we were serving were from Wasatch County, about 55 to 60 are Summit, and then the remaining are from other parts of the state.
And how has that moved? I mean, if I go back 5 years, what would that have looked like?
Oh, I think that we were probably aiming more around like between 15 and 20% mm-hmm. from Wasatch County. And, so it's gone up.
And when you do an event at the library, how do you raise community consciousness? Tell us a little about what would an event at the library be?
Yeah, well, it really is more of a drop-in type mm-hmm. of service. So we're there, we provide flyers, we put information out, we share that, you know, through social media and also through our newsletter, through our community partners. We have a number of partners in Wasatch County as well that we work closely with. We're part of a health coalition, the Wasatch County Latino Coalition, so that those folks are able to share that information broadly. And then when an individual comes in, they can come into the library and it can look just like, you know, I'm going in to check out a book. And they can be directed over to where our outreach advocate is at. The same thing with the food bank. You know, here's some information. What we find is that oftentimes people may not, you know, initially engage in services in that space. They take the information and they call later. Mm. And that's, you know, the really important part, I think, because again, we want people to be comfortable with the information and be able to feel like they can safely reach out when it's appropriate for them. So it's really about having a physical face in the community and continuing to provide that outreach and awareness that services are available.
Now, we've talked about sort of changes in your population with respect to Wasatch County. Are you also seeing increases in Spanish-speaking survivors, and is that a staffing challenge for you?
Yeah, you know, so we have worked really hard over the years, I would say probably starting about 8-9 years ago, to increase our bilingual staff, because I could tell you 10 years ago is we were not seeing as many of our Spanish-speaking clients coming into services. And that very much spoke to the fact that, you know, we didn't have many people who spoke the primary language that other people were speaking. So we worked very consciously to increase that. And now what we are seeing is that some of those programs are some of our most successful. Our Spanish-speaking support groups are very well attended. We have a group, you know, called Puente Comunitario that provides information to individuals in our community on a variety of topics, including those that are related to our mission, but other things like mental health and suicide prevention and other resources. So we have probably about 30 to 35% of our staff are bilingual Spanish speaking. And then in cases where somebody speaks another language, or if one of our Spanish speaking staff are not available, we're able to use interpreter services. What I'm really proud to say is that we have a Spanish speaking staff member, at least one in every single program in Peace House. And, you know, we're always working to increase that, because even if somebody does speak English, sometimes they're much more comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah, speaking in their primary language, especially when you're sitting down with a therapist, if you can imagine.
And you're talking about traumatic situations.
Exactly. Yeah. We want to make sure that people have the resources that they need and that they are accessible in the language that is most appropriate for them.
What kind of education are you doing? Actually, I attended a program of yours with law enforcement.
Yeah.
And what kind of interaction do you have with law enforcement? Do you think there's more work to be done to get officers trauma-informed? Are you having a good relationship with Summit County and Wasatch County Sheriff's Offices?
We have a really great relationship. We have been working really hard to strengthen our relationships in both counties. And here in Summit County, we work really closely with the Sheriff's Office and the Park City Police Department. Obviously, we're in the Park City jurisdiction. You know, being a publicly disclosed location, we work closely with them on safety.
Yeah.
And, you know, our emergency management response plan. So we're really grateful. Anytime they have new officers come on board, we invite them in for a tour of the facility so that they can understand what we're doing behind our closed doors. We educate them on our confidentiality regulations, because sometimes that can be a little bit of a sticking point for us. Because of our federal regulations, we can't share information. But we have been working in concert both with Wasatch and Summit County over the years with our lethality assessment protocol. And that has been really, I think, a great opportunity, not only to strengthen our relationship, but really to strengthen our face and presence for survivors, because we are speaking a very similar language when we're working with survivors. We are able to use a tool that helps us assess the dangerousness of a situation, and we have a protocol where our law enforcement partners, who are those first responders addressing the immediate needs of safety, are able to then rely on Peace House as that 24/7 response. So if somebody needs emergency shelter, they can call the shelter. So if somebody needs to get connected to legal advocacy, they can connect to get a protective order. So we've seen some really incredible work over the years with our partners. We're really excited for this year, as we're stepping into a space where we've been able to strengthen some of our work around strangulation response in the county. And they're actually providing strangulation forensic exams. So we're doing some great work.
Kendra Wyckoff, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Happy New Year, and thanks for listening to the Local News Hour.